This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm very excited to introduce David Litt. From 2011 to 2016, David served in the Obama White House as a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter, one of the youngest in history. Known as the comic muse for the president, he was the lead writer on 4 White House correspondence speeches and wrote jokes for President Obama's speeches since 2009. He's currently the head writer and producer for Funny or Die's office here in D.C. My favorite part of his bio was that he currently lives in D.C. with his fiance and their 2 goldfish. Unfortunately, when I first wrote this, it was 2 other goldfish. I'm told it was now 2 new goldfish. In his new book, Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years, David takes us back to a recent golden age of presidential oratory that was filled with complete sentences instead of tweets. He gives us a behind-the-scenes look at his tenure in the Obama White House, and the book is filled with hilarious moments, but also profound insight into the state of politics today. Already garnering tons of praise from New Republic, Kirkus Reviews, David Axelrod, and just a couple of quotes from the Times Review. Litt is a funny and skillful storyteller. The first half of the book is enjoyable. The second half is masterly, rising to a crescendo that is as rousing as, well, a particularly inspiring campaign speech. He'll be in conversation tonight with Alexandra Petri. Alexandra's an opinion writer with the Washington Post, where she writes the Compost. So without further ado, please help me in welcoming them to Politics and Prose.
Yay! Ooh, is this thing on?
Are these on?
Or can people, ooh, okay. It is on? Wonderful. So condolences on the goldfish.
Yeah. So just to be clear, the new goldfish, Florence and Dwayne, are doing fine, although Florence has a minor injury and we're a little worried. There's goldfish antibiotics being administered.
This is a whole brave new world of pet ownership, and
yes.
I kind of want to just ask about your goldfish.
Yeah, we're actually just going to talk about goldfish for the next... I could. My next memoir will be a memoir of goldfish ownership, but for now we can talk about this book.
Yes. No, so one of the things that struck me is a lot of the people who were saying really nice things about your book were also saying it's really necessary and it's a nice sort of window into a bygone era that we all miss so much. How did, like, the sort of wave of nostalgia hit you?
Well, I started writing the book in the beginning of 2016, so I did not think we were going to be nearly as nostalgic for Barack Obama. Or as in need of escape as we are right now. I had an epilogue ready to go the night of the election. That changed pretty substantially. And one of the things that happened as I went back through the book was realizing all of these little things that didn't seem like they were supposed to be, you know, sort of trappings of a bygone age, but suddenly were. So I talked... Mostly as I was trying to establish context, in one chapter I talked about how the president, at the end of some of the jokes he would say, usually these were to the press, so he would say some nice things about the importance of a free press. That was just supposed to help readers understand what was going on, not to make us pine for a past where a president didn't threaten reporters with violence, but here we are.
Yeah, I was struck because you were saying that you actually had to write out how to pronounce difficult-to-pronounce words, and then the president pronounced them correctly. And I was like, man, just a little thing.
Yeah, well, maybe they have, like, the phonetic of Covfefe in the Trump White House. I also, before we go further, thank you all for being here, especially the, like, at least dozen of you I've never met, so I appreciate that. And also, thank you for hosting. My strategy on this book tour is to find people who I would just want to have a conversation with, and then we can have a conversation, and then if people are here, that's great, and I'm glad there are, but it's sort of incidental to the whole thing. But we appreciate it. Please buy books.
Yeah, you're invisible to us. No. but I guess, so... Maybe we should do, like, the whole David Copperfield thing where we rewind to your birth and, like, proceed on, like, through Obama and then to death.
Well, the last part sounds unpleasant, but sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll hopefully avoid that. But so, like, was your family funny? Like, how did you get into this?
No, my family was not funny. For me, rebelling in high school was... I was too timid to rebel any of the normal, more fun ways. So my way of rebelling was to be... the 15-year-old who would go to comedy clubs and do amateur stand-up comedy, because that was the last thing that my parents, I think, could ever possibly imagine me doing. And what's funny about this is that after you leave the White House, you get to take, this is one of those things where I realize the tenses need to change. I have no idea what happens after you leave the White House. Now you go on, you go to the Emmys, but back in the olden days, after you left the White House, you got to take a departure photo with the president. And so I brought my parents and I brought Jackie, my fiance, and the first thing President Obama said was, "So, which of you two does he get a sense of humor from?" And both of my parents, the answer is neither. And both of my parents, without missing a beat, immediately were like, "Oh, that was totally me." And I've never seen them claim to be funny in any other context, but the moment they were standing in the Oval with the president, they could not wait to claim credit.
That's funny. Their whole lives up to that point had been deep commitment to the bit of just being like, "Yes, I'm the funny one. All along it was me."
Yeah, exactly. And this was their time to unleash it.
Wait, so did they drive you to the stand-up gigs? I'm actually, or like, how
well,
did you?
Well, I grew up in New York City, so we didn't drive. But I went to Stand Up New York, which is a couple blocks from where I grew up. And I did, because I was 15, I needed a chaperone. So my mom would take me. She was very patient about it. And she would, like, take me to, you know, comedy night on Tuesdays, which wasn't necessarily always great. And or I'd go with my friends. We'd have, like, six high school kids. And sitting in the very front of a comedy club, which is sort of asking for it from comedians. If things aren't going well, like, yeah, they turn on the six high school kids in the front who aren't drinking. So, so we've covered the birth, and hopefully we'll avoid the death.
No, yeah, so Obama. So talk me through, like, a normal day working in, like, the speech writing wing of the, like, you described it very humorously as, like, the world's, like, most type A sweatshop, I think.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about being a speechwriter as opposed to maybe some of the other jobs, some of the policy jobs, is that you went through these cycles. It was sort of like crashing, like cramming for a final exam every 2 weeks, where you would start with an assignment, essentially just, where's the president going? What is he going to say? You have to do the research. You have to meet with policy people and, sometimes outreach liaisons, anybody who has an interest in the speech and the outcome of it. And then you sit down and you do the writing. It goes back to all the people who have to look at it. In the Obama White House, from what I understand, we had a relatively smaller list. It wasn't in the Clinton White House. What I always heard was kind of everyone could take a look at the draft. And in the Obama White House, it was much more controlled who was editing and who was not. But it's still a lot of people who could take a look, make a change. And then it would go to the chief speechwriter. So that was Jon Favreau in the first term and Cody Keenan in the second. And after that, it would go to the president himself. But you go through that cycle, you know, with these ups and downs all the time. And so it's also one of the rare White House jobs where you might actually have a day to kind of think just a little bit because you're between speeches. That didn't happen all the time, but sometimes it did.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, thinking day. Imagine that being built into any White House.
Yeah, well, that would be nice.
Yeah. There's a story involving Betty White that I thought was just hilarious because, like, it turns out the Golden Girls will get you really far in life. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So the story you're referring to, this was my first ever Oval Office meeting. I had met the president once. He asked me, "How's it going?" And I have no idea what I said. I literally blacked out. And I had made a promise to myself that if I ever got another chance to make a first impression on President Obama, I was going to do a better job. I was not going to let myself down. And I wasn't sure if that was ever going to happen, but Jon Favreau called me in the office, and he said, "Betty White is turning 90 years old, and NBC is doing this comedy special where different famous people are wishing her a happy birthday in these 30-second skits, and you're pretty funny, and no one else wants to do it. So do you want to give it a shot?" And I said, "Absolutely." And again, I get that this is not the State of the Union, but this was my Gettysburg Address. And so John and I came up with a joke. I picked out a second birthday card because we were filming from multiple camera angles, so I wanted to make sure that there were, you know, two birthday cards so you couldn't tell the president had already written in a birthday card. I thought at the end it would be funny to see Barack Obama put in headphones and pretend to listen to the theme song from The Golden Girls. At the time, we all knew that this was, like, back in 2011, it was kind of cool that he had an iPod, if you remember from 2008, and we had never seen him with headphones in, so I thought this would be big. And I found the perfect pair of headphones, and I went into the Oval Office totally prepared, And the moment I was there looking at the president, I fell apart completely. And so I tried to explain this joke and failed utterly. And it was me and Hope Hall, who some of you here know, who was the videographer for the president. It was just the three of us. Could not explain this joke. I tried to give the second birthday card to the president, who politely but firmly explained that he did not need a second birthday card, so why was I doing this? And I reached into my pocket to give him the headphones, and I pulled out what looked like a hairball made out of wires. And that's just how I tend to keep headphones, is just...
It's the most efficient way, yeah.
But I didn't know what to do, so I just handed the entire thing to the president of the United States. And those of us who, certainly my former colleagues who are here tonight, we've all heard the phrase, there's no commodity on earth more valuable than a president's time, which I always thought was a cliche, until I watched Barack Obama untangle headphones for 30 seconds while looking directly at me. And when he finished, he turned to Hope and he just went, shoddy advance work. In this way, but in this way where he was sort of letting you know that A, he's just joking, and also B, he is not even a tiny bit joking. And I was pretty sure, I mean, this was, as I put in the book, this was my third chance to make a second first impression on the president, and I had totally blown it. And I'm sort of about to leave the Oval Office with my head hung in disgrace, and we're about to film the final scene. And President Obama says, well, should I bob my head in time to the music? Wouldn't that be funnier? And I say, yes, it would be funnier. But I'm not really in it anymore. I know that I've let myself down. And President Obama suddenly stops us right before we film that final scene. And he says, well, hang on. If I'm going to bob my head in time to the music, I need to know how the music goes. Does anyone here know the Golden Girls theme song? And President Obama looks at Hope, and Hope doesn't say anything. So I look at Hope, and Hope doesn't say anything. So President Obama looks at me, and suddenly, I know what I can do for my country. And so I'm sitting, or standing rather, in the Oval Office, and I look the Commander-in-Chief in the eye, and I say, bum, 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 thank you for being a friend. Bum, 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 bum. And I will say, it was not the best performance of the Golden Girls theme song, but President Obama bobbed his head in time to the music, Betty White got her card, and so I left my first ever Oval Office meeting feeling like the President of the United States was a tiny bit better at his job because I was in the room. And so for me, that was my equivalent of a triumph.
That sounds like a great triumph, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly it was not a thing I expected to happen. It's what you start in the White House and you imagine making history. And a lot of this book is about making the kind of history you did not exactly expect to make. And I also always wonder, because there was a Secret Service agent in the hallway, but he couldn't see in. And so I always wonder if he's telling this story of like the day he was at work and somebody just started singing the Golden Girls theme song for no reason.
Like, what's the silent version of that? I guess he could hear it. But
yeah, he could hear it.
No, so you were saying, like, I feel like as a millennial 20-something, I don't know if that's redundant anymore or not. I feel like we were sort of moving gradually towards death. The theme of this Q&A, apparently.
Not for me.
But, yeah, no, but our first sort of vision of what politics was like was the West Wing. And you sort of debunked that a little bit. You're like, was there any West Wing moment, or were you?
There definitely were. And one of the things I wanted to write about in the book was the sort of ratio between these kind of West Wing moments and Veep moments, if you're going to classify them. And it is more, I think all of us who worked in the White House were big Veep fans because it captured the day-to-day of life in the White House. But there were these moments. I write about the night that the marriage equality decision passed or went through, was handed down. And that also was the same day that President Obama had gone to Charleston and delivered that eulogy where he sang Amazing Grace. And Jackie and I were, just a few of the hundreds, thousands of people who went to the White House and were standing outside this building where our president lived. And it was lit up in the colors of the rainbow. And if you played the West Wing theme song in that moment, it would have made perfect sense. And then there were other times where, for example, you're running late to a meeting because Ike's, the cafeteria, discounts their buffet food from 2 to 2:30. And so you put off getting lunch, and now you're behind on your schedule, where, like, if the West Wing started at that moment, it would make less sense.
And does House of Cards even enter into the mix at all?
Yeah, I murdered people.
Okay. Good, I'm glad. So death, we got to death,
yeah, we
finally.
Did. Yes, that's right. We
Other
finally reached death.
Death.
Yeah. No, I don't, it's funny, I feel like as somebody who came to D.C. because of the new president and then ended up working in the administration, I don't know a ton of people who work on the Hill, but I always feel like Hill people I know like House of Cards because it is their fantasy, and administration people liked Veep because it was their reality. But I don't know, maybe not.
No, that's interesting. I feel like, so how did you get involved initially? You started out as a campaign volunteer, and then it trickled upwards?
Yeah, I guess so. I started in 2008. I was a college senior. I was one of the many, many college seniors who heard Barack Obama give a speech. I saw him on TV. And by the time the speech was done, I was somebody who would not shut up about Barack Obama. And the fact that I've now written a book called Thanks, Obama indicates that's more or less the path I've stayed on ever since. And I started off as a volunteer on campus. I, you know, knocked on doors. I bothered voters. And then 2 weeks after I graduated in 2008, I got in the car and drove to Ohio and worked field. That's only one chapter of the book, but I did want to include it because there's lots of White House books, but there's very few that deal with field organizing, which I feel like is sort of a, like, that's a part of politics that almost everyone that I know has participated in some point, but it doesn't get covered in the, like, Hollywood version or even the kind of, you know, like wearing a blazer, talking in a bookstore version.
Yeah, wait, so tell me more about the field organizing part.
Well, so what I talk about in field was, well, to begin with, our local Democratic Party county chair in Wayne County, Ohio, who despised me because she was a Hillary voter, and she sort of saw Obama as a young upstart, and I was like 21, and I was not a senator, so I don't even want to think about what she thought of me. And it was an interesting experience kind of trying to bring people together in what was a pretty red county in Ohio. It was a little bit like everybody was in the closet politically. Like, people would walk into our office to make phone calls for the first time and be shocked to find out that they had friends who were Democrats. And one of the things that was really special about it was that feeling of there's the campaign, there's everything going on nationally, but the way the universe just shrinks to this one county in Ohio, this one set of volunteers, and there are these big national issues, but also so much of it is personal. The sense of not just Barack Obama became the first African American president, but, you know, Worcester, the city of Worcester, Ohio, was the first. It was the first time it went for a Democrat since Lyndon Johnson. That's something that,
oh, wow,
I and only a few other people care about, but we care about it a lot.
Yeah, how's Worcester County doing now? Has it reverted?
Yeah, it's more than reverted. Wayne County. I mean, Wayne County was one of the sort of the very, like, archetypal counties that went for Romney by a little bit more than they went for McCain, and then by Trump for a lot more. So it was interesting. I went back there during the campaign this year to do some volunteering, and you started to see it was one of those things that, like, maybe that was a moment when I should have had my, like, Peggy Noonan, this is where I saw it coming, but it's only in retrospect that you see it.
No, so I'm actually curious about, I'm suddenly blank mid-sentence on, well, I'm curious about many things, but I feel like, speaking of other presidents, if you could pick any other president to have written speeches for historically, just like lightning round, who would it have been?
I would say in terms of the speeches, I'm trying to think of someone who's a little underrated. And LBJ actually gave great speeches. I mean, he apparently was like a monster to his speechwriter, so I'm not sure that I would
to go to the bathroom with him.
Right.
He just, like, swinging it around.
Yeah.
Reputedly.
Right, yeah. I like it. Recovering death, recovering the bathroom habits of LBJ. We're really getting, you all are getting your money's worth. I think that, I think he gave... And interestingly, he was not a natural orator like some of the presidents who we think of as great speakers. So it's to go back and read through his speeches, you see the sort of quality that you may not have always seen if you listen to them or something like that.
And so going back to like 2008, I know like Sarah Palin's sort of like the boogeyman in this book in a lot of ways, which it's funny because it's like, oh, this menace is this like hypothetically an unqualified person might potentially wind up in the highest office in the land. So how does it feel looking back on Sarah Palin now when you're like at the distance of 2017?
Well, it is weird sort of like what you used to worry about. It is true. But I also think one of the things that I wanted to talk about in the book was the way that not just what I saw and what my colleagues saw in the White House, but we were here in Washington during a time when something sort of fundamentally shifted in the Republican Party. And to me, Sarah Palin was the moment that things changed a lot. And I talk about when I was in the field, there were already these concerns. People, you'd go to a voter's door and you would say, what's your concern about Obama? And you would have boxes to check, you know, the economy, healthcare, the environment. And somebody would say, well, he's a terrorist. And you're like, there's no box for that. But after Palin was the nominee, then things got really dark. Especially like outside of the town of Worcester, people started telling me that, you know, they had yard signs that they wake up in the morning and someone's used them for target practice, or, you know, a mailbox gets knocked off the post. And that attitude where it's not so much that we're Americans trying to sort out our differences as we're Americans and they're not, and we're determined to fight them, that changed, and that came to Washington. So I did want to tell that story, even though I wasn't on the front lines of it, in the same way that I saw, you know, I was kind of inside the White House.
But you still are optimistic, ultimately.
Yeah, it's funny, somebody today, I guess, heard something about my book, a friend of mine who I worked with on the high school newspaper, and dug up like an old humor article I had written in high school, which was
like Bush era.
Yeah, so 2003, and it was a reminder that we thinking that the world is falling apart is not new. And the headline I had written, our school motto was "Go forth unafraid," and I had changed the joke was that the motto was being changed because of everything going on in the world to "Go forth cautiously optimistic." And I'm glad you liked that. I'm glad we're just having this conversation, because otherwise I would have noticed that no one else found that funny.
Yeah, with the microphone, it really amplifies.
It really brings it all out. But I do think that this sort of, it was a weird thing to do with a book, because I think a lot of DC books operate on this continuum where you're either naive and idealistic, or you become realistic and cynical. And I wanted to try to do something that was a little bit more nuanced, where what I would think about now is I hope that I'm sort of both realistic and idealistic at the same time. And it's sort of an arrival, it's going from optimism to cautious optimism, if that makes sense. And the fact that that's not, a lot of the writing and rewriting of the book, and I'm very happy with how it ended up, but one of the reasons that I went through a lot of drafts of it was because that's not the easiest story to tell, because it's not the biggest dramatic arc. But I thought it was the truest, and also the most important to get out there and maybe kind of add something different to the genre of White House books.
That's cool. I think like irony as a sort of a stock in trade for like humor has had an interesting journey, because now I feel like people are they're not as ashamed as they used to be to like actually put themselves out there and be earnest in a way that I think is positive. And I know like the Kennedy sort of quintessential musical was Camelot, and everyone was like, oh, this is the Camelot age. And the Obama era had like Hamilton, and Hamilton's it's very nerdy and very earnest, and sort of like, I wonder if that's like Obama era, or if that's sort of millennials, or I'm just sort of vaguely waving my arm and saying buzzwords, but I do think like humor as a lens for getting your information is something millennials grew up with. You got like Jon Stewart, you got The Daily Show. And when there was a switch from Bush to Obama, everyone was like, well, now what are we gonna do? Because suddenly the class clown has become the teacher's pet, like from a political standpoint. So how did you go about making jokes from within the house, you know?
Yeah, well, for us, I think it was, in some ways, the real question when you're writing jokes for a politician is just, are they good or not at delivering a joke? So we were extremely lucky, all of us who wrote jokes for the president, and one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that joke writing, as opposed to most of the speech writing we did, was a team effort. So we'd have 12 or 15 people pitching jokes, but all of us would know that whatever the president decides to say, he's going to do a really good job. He has really good timing. So I think that was the biggest concern. And then thinking about how to sort of cross small lines, but the lines are sort of circumscribed by the fact that the president is the president. These things would not be edgy. Sometimes I retell jokes that President Obama said, and nobody finds them particularly funny, which makes total sense because they're not edgy or sharp for me. But when they're in the mouth of a president, because in the olden days, the bar for what a president would say was different for what someone else would say. You could sort of break those rules in a fun way. I will also say, even though it was probably difficult for the Colbert writers or the Daily Show writers, there was also this weird point of pride. The very, very first speech I wrote for Obama, he went to Puerto Rico. And I just threw in as much Puerto Rico stuff as I could to the point where the Daily Show picked it up and made fun of it that night. And I remember being a little embarrassed and also so happy. Because something I wrote was on the Daily Show and they were mocking it, but still.
Yeah, it's there.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Now, so what do you think is the role of humor sort of continuing forward in this era where obviously as the president's punching down, as you're saying, and people are like, what do we do? How do we joke? How do we live?
Yeah, I think...
Yeah.
I do think that one of the things that I think is important is there is this weird school of thought that says comedy will save us, and I don't think that's going to happen. I remember we talked about this during the election, where it's when people ask me I want to get involved in changing what's going on, how do I get into something like where I'm working now at Funny or Die? I'm like, that you it's fine, you can do that, but if you want to change America, you should join a political campaign. You should not become a comedy writer. It's not the fastest route to change. I do think comedy has two roles to play. One is just helping us preserve our sanity. There is, for all of the scary stuff, it's also ridiculous, and I think being able to acknowledge that just lets people live a little bit. I mean, this has been, 9 months and 50,000 years, and we're going to have a long way to go. And I think the other thing is that satire in particular still is about finding truth, and it's about both in terms of the precision of the language and the idea that words matter, and not just the thoughts, that's important, but careful construction and expertise in that way and artistry, but also trying to find out what is really the truth of this thing. If you can't, you can't make a joke about something unless you really understand it most of the time, and certainly you can't do good satire unless you understand an issue. And in a world where the White House talks about alternative facts, that becomes an act of resistance, even though it shouldn't be. That should not be something that we're excited that comedians are telling the truth, because the president and the press secretary should be telling the truth.
Yeah, it's like, I described this thing accurately. Yay! Right. Oh, man, I really socked it to them.
Yeah, it's a way that the bar has been lowered. I hope we can raise it back, but for now, the bar has been lowered on kind of what is resistance and what is not. I do think, thinking about when I go out to L.A. and I talk with people at Funny or Die, it is strange. I think everybody in the comedy world, the same way that lots of people in the world outside of D.C. just want to get back to a point where they didn't care about politics, I think there's lots of people in comedy who are like, please, just let us go back to writing fart jokes. This is why we did this. We didn't want to be heroes. We didn't want to, be truth tellers. We just wanted to do things that were silly and get paid. And I do hope we get back to that point. But for now, we're where we're at.
Yeah, we got to bring back the fart joke, I think, is the takeaway from this book. But unrelated to... the fart joke is the earliest form of humor. Aristophanes is 100% fart jokes, and the other percentage of it is dong jokes. Golly, I'm just 100% LBJ's... we're going with it.
Yeah, no, this is... At some point, we'll transition back to death, and then it'll be fine. Was that a question?
That was a yes.
Okay. I think that... I do think that comedy right now, it is a weird thing, too, where a friend of mine who writes for SNL who had pitched jokes to the president, one of the fun things about writing jokes for Obama was that you could go to any of your comedy heroes and say, hey, would you like to write jokes for President Obama? And no one was going to say no. So you got to meet and work with these incredible people. And she was saying that, there's also the thing that they're trying to think about at SNL, where, or at least that she's thinking about, where they... talk about clapter as opposed to laughter, right? You can get a very easy laugh by just saying Donald Trump is a bad man, and people will laugh, but what they really mean is I agree with you. And so I do think there's also, for those of us who are doing comedy, you need to also check yourself and say, is this really funny or am I just expressing a popular opinion? And I hope that both of those things will continue to be true.
Yeah, because I feel like if you can make people laugh at an unpopular opinion, then you've successfully done something.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, at Funny or Die, one of the things we're actually really proud of is we did Between Two Ferns with President Obama, obviously in 2014, but we also did Between Two Ferns with Hillary Clinton and during the campaign. And while we weren't thrilled necessarily about the outcome of the campaign, the Kid Rock retweeted or put on Facebook, he shared
Senator
that
Kid
video.
Rock.
Yeah, Senator Rock. He shared our Between Two Ferns on Facebook and said, I don't care what your political views are, funny is funny. And that we want to do comedy with a point, but we also want to do comedy that is so good that you can't help but laugh at it. And there were moments when President Obama would tell a joke and you knew it was just the Democrats in the room laughing, but there were also moments when he would do something that was where something would be good enough that you feel like everybody is laughing, and those were the things that I'm really proud of looking back on it, because you feel like then you cleared a higher bar.
Because I feel like the Obamas now exist at this fascinating intersection of like politics and celebrity, where everyone sort of feels that they own a piece of them. Like own is a freighted word, and I think like maybe the right word for the wrong reasons, but like you feel like you're entitled to a certain amount of their sort of like time and their essence, and everyone's like, so and so is my best friend, and like I need to have them in my life. Like, how do you see them navigating that? Did you sort of get a sense of?
No, one small way that I did see that I thought was kind of interesting was the time that I overheard the president say one of the things he liked about meeting babies was that they didn't know who he was. Like, this was they were the only people who he could just play around with, and they didn't black out when they met the president. They may still not remember what happened, but that's for different reasons. And I do think that is, but and one of the things that I also wanted to write about in the book was, you know, I was not somebody who knew the president well personally. I was not in the inner circle making decisions. But like so many of us, I felt this kind of personal relationship, not with Barack Obama, the man, but with the persona and with the idea. And in a way that I feel we now all have a personal relationship with President Trump. My relationship with President Trump is not as good, but it exists. And I think wanting to get at how, yes, these are political issues, but they end up feeling very personal, and trying to, in the book, bring it back to not just what was going on, but what was it like, how did it affect my emotional life in that moment, not just the sort of, you know, here's what happened on that day.
Because I think, like, if you're, at what point does it become like a political ideas-based contest, like you were saying in your organizing section, versus, oh, like, this person is one of the in-group, or this person, like, I'd like to have a beer with him, like the old age-old question. Are we in fully beer land now, or milkshake land, as the Trump case may be?
Right. I don't know. I think that I'm not as against the sort of idea of who would I want to have a beer with, you know, as maybe some people are. I think most, the conclusion I kind of came away with was that most people want to know who is going to think about them at a moment when a tough decision is being made. So I write in the book about a little girl named Zoe Lynn. Her mom spoke at the 2012 convention. Zoe was born with a heart condition that's pretty similar to Jimmy Kimmel's son, and needed two open heart surgeries in the first 6 months of her life. More or less, I mean, you could parse it a little bit, but I think it's fair to say that she is alive now because of the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things I write about in the book is, to me, what was important about President Obama was, when a decision had to be made, is he going to be thinking about the insurance company that wants to save some money, or is he going to be thinking about Zoe? And so people are using that personal relationship as a cue to say, okay, I think this person is going to be thinking about me, because the issues are, there's just too many things that come up, and they're too complicated, and also we don't know what the next, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years, nobody knows what the big fight is going to be, so you need someone you need to figure out who you think is going to be on your side regardless. Should we do some audience questions?
Yeah,
I just thought we should get to the Q&A.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's cool.
Step on up.
All right, there we go.
Hi. You know, thank you for a delightful presentation, and you are most blessed to have had that experience, without a doubt. Did you have the opportunity to encounter Valerie Jarrett, the awesome Valerie Jarrett?
I did encounter the awesome Valerie Jarrett. I started off writing speeches for her, so that was my first White House job, was writing for Valerie and the other senior staff. And I know I see a whole bunch of Office of Public Engagement alumni here tonight. So, yes.
Yeah, well, she happens to be a she-ro. I think she's fabulous. You mentioned, just one other thing, because you mentioned Charleston. And did I understand you to say you went with the president?
No, I watched that from my office on the live stream, Americans, just watching it on the screen.
Who would have helped him prepare for that? So his, or did he need it?
So his chief speechwriter, Cody Keenan, who was my boss during the second term, he was the one who went with the president on that speech and on other big speeches. And one of the things that to me was, I thought I could sort of talk about a little in the book that was a little different, was the experience of not being the, where your direct boss is the president, but the president's kind of your boss's boss. And that just seemed like a different angle from which to write.
Okay. Well, I hope you'll get to go to Mother Emanuel. You must do that.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Hi. I just want to say, watching the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the last one, was by far one of the funniest, just even stand-up routines, and that it was by the Commander-in-Chief. I thought that was really good. I just wanted to, I was just curious if you had a favorite memory, like the funniest thing that you've ever heard President Obama do, or if there's some story that you guys always shared around around the office.
Well, I will say the correspondence dinner you talked about was the one after I left the White House, so which is totally fine. But I do feel the need to give, Tyler Lechtenberg, one of my colleagues on the speechwriting team, ran the dinner that year. And one of the things to me was I felt it was important to leave knowing that I was not indispensable to the president, that I could leave and the speeches would be great and the jokes would be great and everything would be fine without me. And I think your question demonstrates that. when you talk about sort of what were there kind of stories or things like that, no, I mean, I talked, you know, when I think about the funnier side, it's almost the things that I remember as kind of special moments were not so much the president doing something funny as the president laughing in a meeting or laughing in private, because I think that you sort of see the public persona is someone telling a joke. If someone tells a joke one way in private, they probably tell it somewhat similarly in public. But when somebody laughs, that's kind of a more intimate moment. And so whether, you know, I'm talking about the president when Keegan-Michael Key came in as Luther the Anger Translator and President Obama could not keep it together in rehearsal, or the time I had to tell him that in a Photoshopped slide that we were going to use, we had to take it out because he looked like Hitler. Which, if you had seen the slide, you would understand. It makes no, like, I know it seems beyond belief, but it was totally true, so we took it out. But I've never seen him laugh that hard as when he heard me say that. And so, to me, that says a lot about somebody. I cannot imagine how our current president might react to that, for example.
I was just wondering if there's anything that sort of stood out to you when you left the White House and then subsequently moved to LA, that you were like, this mattered so much while I was in the White House, and now that I'm in LA, I feel like this doesn't matter at all.
I live in D.C.
Sorry,
totally fine. Yeah. I work for Funny or Die in D.C., so I'm in L.A. a bunch. I do think it's still a good question to me, because I think the thing that I forgot was that people are not paying attention to everything the president does at every moment. I used to write message events, which were, I kind of described them as like routine maintenance on your car, but for speech writing. So the president goes to a place, he talks about a thing, he announces a policy, and you do two or three of them a week just to try to control the news cycle as best you can. And, you know, they're not going to end up in the history books, but I sort of assumed, given how hard I worked on them, that everybody in America knew about them. And then when I left the White House, even living in D.C., I would talk to my colleagues and realize what they were doing that week, and I might not have heard of it. And certainly when you go to LA or when you go outside of DC, realizing that our understanding of who the president is and what they're doing is not shaped by everything they've done, but sort of by moments, and you don't always know which moments are going to be the ones that break through and change our public perception of the president.
Yeah, thank you very much for your presentations. When I watched President Obama speak, I always felt he had a very good sense of humor and could create jokes on his own. Not necessarily that those are the ones that I heard, but I was wondering how much truth is that? I mean, was he good at kind of creating his jokes or contributing to the creation of the jokes?
Yeah.
That eventually one heard on television or?
Definitely. So President Obama never, we wouldn't go into the Oval and he would say, well, I've been up all night working on some really good lines because he had other things to do. But I think when the American people got a sense this is a guy with a good sense of humor, that's not, an accident. It's because he has a really good sense of humor. And whether it was sort of an ad lib in a speech, I talk about the State of the Union when he said, I have no more campaigns to run, and Republicans started clapping, and he said, yeah, that's because I won both of them. And that wasn't in the script. I mean, that was just him kind of reading the moment.
Yeah, right.
And similarly, even in the correspondence centers, he would make edits sometimes, and if he really liked a joke, he would usually tag it, or, you know, he'd say, like, oh, I'm going to add a little wave there. You know, it's just something to kind of personalize it. And then the other thing that, particularly in the last couple of correspondence centers, he would sometimes just go on a run of jokes that were not in the script. And the fact that people didn't know that, I think, speaks to how precisely his sort of command of language is, or certainly was as president. I don't know if you all remember Cliven Bundy, to go back to the last question, this is the thing about D.C. versus outside of D.C., where I'm like, remember Cliven Bundy? And everyone's heads are like, of course we do. And if I was anywhere else, people would be like, that doesn't sound like a person.
Sounds like a yogurt.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Probiotic Cliven Bundy. And so the Nevada rancher who had a sort of stood up in something or other against the Bureau of Land Management, and then turned out like he was a hero on the right, and then turned out to be quite racist at a time when that was still a problem, and then the president told some joke that was mostly about Rand Paul, who had invited him to the dinner and then disinvited him after the scandal broke, but then he just went on a run for like 20 or 30 seconds. And it was really funny. Like, it was not, there was no point where I thought, oh my gosh, he's going off script and trying to tell jokes. I was like, this is really good. And so that moment was, you know, that kind of thing was really special. And that command of, you know, that being able to ad lib a joke in that way is a pretty rare gift, not just for presidents, but for human beings.
Hi, I was wondering if you were involved in the now infamous 2011 Correspondents' Dinner, where Barack Obama made fun of Donald Trump, and a lot of people kind of point to that as his "I'm running" moment.
So I had just started at the White House in 2011. The Correspondents' Dinner that year, I was about 4 weeks in. So John Lovett, who I'm sure many of you know from his podcasts, he was the speechwriter running the joke process that year, and I was pitching jokes. But I didn't write the Trump-related ones. I sort of saw them come in the draft. They were only in the final draft. And I remember, because they were trying to figure out, what are we going to do about Trump and this whole birther thing? And then the final draft, I was like, oh, they're doing that. Wow. And so I was in the cheap seats and kind of watching the back of Trump's head as he sort of dove inside himself with rage. But I don't think that that's, I mean, people think that that's why he ran, and who knows, but my own theory is, first of all, he had clearly developed a taste for politics. This was not an accident that President Obama was making fun of him. He was on this kind of birther tour and all over Fox News. But then also, to me, the thing that Trump really wanted, it wasn't so much revenge, it was envy. You have a president standing up there, everybody is enjoying them, admiring what they're doing. It's Hollywood celebrities, Washington media people. You know, we've got politicians. These are all of the people whose approval Trump has craved his entire life, and the president is getting it. And I think that he had this moment where I was like, oh, if I was the one standing over there, I would get that kind of approval. But it turns out it's not so easy.
What is your take on the lack of humor in the current administration?
I think it is. I mean, to me, it's not in and of itself a problem. It is reflective of all of the other problems that when you and the biggest thing it's reflective of is, generally speaking, for politicians, humor is used to A, acknowledge that we're all only human, which is important in a democracy, or B, it's used to kind of build bridges to people who might not agree with you anyway. And the fact that Trump can't do either of those things, that he can't acknowledge that his ego and his self is not the single most important thing on the planet, and also that he can't find a way to reach out to people who maybe didn't vote for him, but to say, well, you can still enjoy, you know, people who didn't vote for President Obama could relate to the way he cared about his family or could find him funny. There were all these ways you could build small bridges, even if our politics is broken and partisan and all of that. And the fact that Trump can't do that and then finds it almost offensive when he doesn't get the response he wants, he sort of tunnels further and further into this world where he's only speaking to his base. And I think that's exactly what we saw yesterday night in Alabama.
And with that, I think I'm going to call that the last question. How about one more round of applause for David?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.